Going smoke-free, earning billions softer government regulations could help this brand. This is Porter & Company's Best Buys, which we publish on the fourth Saturday of the month. You can go here to see past Best Buys. Everyone knew why Harold Watkins really ate the shotgun. It was January 1939 and Watkins, who'd been let go from his job at Massengill Chemist Company about 6 months earlier, was, according to his wife, cleaning his gun, which led to an accidental discharge. The police said it was suicide. The newspaper obit said Harold was the chemist of death. It had, in fact, been Harold's bright idea to mix sulfa medicine, the nation's new miracle drug, with a convenient binding agent that turned out to be toxic antifreeze. With a dollop of red food coloring and raspberry syrup, and without any product testing on humans or animals, 633 lots of Watkins sulfanilamide elixir were shipped to pharmacies across America in fall 1937. By the time a panicked Massengill chemist scrambled to recall them with telegrams like product may be dangerous to life, return at our expense, about 130 people had died. Make that 131, if you count the disgraced Harold Watkins. And President Franklin D. Roosevelt was secretly delighted. FDR's sweeping vision for a welfare state, which he described as a matter of social duty, saw the launch of dozens of bloated government agencies by 1937, including the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, the Social Security Administration, SSA, the Works Progress Administration, WPA, and the Federal Housing Administration, FHA. So far, though, there was no FDA, Food and Drug Administration, as we know it today, just a tiny task force within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, enforcing a bare-bones piece of 1906 legislation called the Pure Food and Drugs Act. Beyond basic standards of truth and labeling, the Pure Food and Drugs Act didn't dictate much. The American public didn't want much. FDR's goons had been not so subtly angling for more government control over food and drugs for several years. Starting in 1933, the administration debuted a traveling chamber of horrors, spotlighting products like Pabst's OK Specific, a gonorrhea remedy that made things, worse. Ruth Lamb, the docent of the exhibit, made sure to hammer home its main point: all of these tragedies have happened, not because government officials are incompetent or callous, but because they have no real power to prevent them. The Chamber of Horrors, entertaining though it was, didn't really move the needle on public opinion. The sulfanilamide tragedy, however, did. In the wave of nationwide horror over the deaths, FDR trotted out a new government bureau whose role was to vet all the food and drugs in the land. He explained in one of his comforting fireside chats, "Only the scientific and disinterested activity of government can protect this honor of our producers and provide the possibility of discriminating choice to our consumers." The FDA billed itself as a consumer protection agency, and what it meant by that is that it wanted absolute control over consumers. In practice, safeguards against quackery are a good thing. That's why we have independent journals and scientific review bodies. But FDR's vision was that the government decides unilaterally what counts as quackery and what doesn't. In his paternal view, giving regular people any information about the chemical or nutritional content of their purchases opened the door to unauthorized practice of medicine. By the 1960s, with the FDA in full swing, it was unlawful to print ingredient lists on most food or medicine, or to mention the word cholesterol on packaging, and in fact, it was illegal to print drug descriptions that were likely to be understood by the ordinary individual. This last law was not fully repealed until 2007. In other words, you were expected to open your mouth for the government's spoon and take your medicine like a good boy. The thalidomide tragedy in the early 1960s, a medicine that caused severe birth defects, gave the FDA an excuse to regulate efficacy as well as safety, thus extending drug pipelines and causing lots of costly delays and backups. Over the next three decades, the FDA mushroomed into a 10,000-person organization with a $1 billion-a-year budget and an increasingly giant mandate that encroached on everything Americans consume: food, medicine, cosmetics, pet food. By the 1970s, they'd extended their purview to medical devices, anything from defibrillators to dental floss. By then, the micromanaging had become so absolute that the FDA routinely did things like seize shipments of expired orange juice at gunpoint and harass local grocery stores until they quit selling apricots, in case someone took it into their head to grind up apricot seeds, a popular alternative cancer treatment in the 70s. Conservatives, especially libertarians, did not go quietly into this good night. Nobel-winning economist Milton Friedman, in particular, had no use for the FDA. The FDA has done enormous harm to the health of the American public by greatly increasing the costs of pharmaceutical research, thereby reducing the supply of new and effective drugs, and by delaying the approval of such drugs as survive the torturous FDA process. Various Reagan-era reforms attempted to pare the agency's powers, but Clinton's 90s brought it roaring back in fine fettle. Which brings us to the tobacco wars. Investigating FOMP cases. Rockville, Maryland, is a nice little town about an hour from Meadowdale Farm, home of Porter & Company. It's also the headquarters for the FDA's little-known armed enforcement branch, the Botox Police. The government spends some $77 million yearly on this 280-man force, known officially as the Office of Criminal Investigations, OCI, and, unofficially, as the bozos who micromanage cosmetic treatments and vitamin pills. Their jurisdiction is separate from the FBI, and their solve rate is laughable, with about 110 convictions out of nearly 1,000 cases in the 2010s. The OCI, complete with sidearms, primarily investigates what's known as FUMP cases, foreign, unapproved medical products, aka off-label Botox. They also conduct elaborate stings that involve buying thousands of dollars worth of supplements from health food stores and then, well, that's it. That's the sting. The Botox Police are the brainchild of a meddling FDA commissioner called David Kessler, who took the reins of the agency in 1990 and, on looking around, realized there was one substance left on Earth that the FDA did not regulate. On his first day in office, as he tells it, an aide came up to him and remarked, "Mr. Commissioner, I think you should take on tobacco. FDA regulates everything else that comes into contact with the body, everything we eat and all our drugs. Why doesn't the FDA regulate tobacco? Why not, indeed? A question to ponder." Kessler is on Bill and Hillary Clinton's Christmas party list. At one of the parties, he got a hold of the President Bill and told him that the best way to go after tobacco was to focus on kids. Shortly thereafter, television PSAs began to appear with Clinton lecturing the youth of America on immoral behavior. To supplement the TV ads, Kessler formed the OCI, who he tasked to go around and conduct armed raids on tobacco fields and facilities that he felt were non-compliant with FDA standards. In a convenient end run around actual law enforcement, he contracted with state governments to use underage youth in tobacco stings, for which he'd then collect civil penalties, some $800,000 in fines by 2000, which, of course, was worth a lot more in 2000. Kessler's main argument was that tobacco was an addictive drug and should be regulated as such. His goal was to classify cigarettes as a drug delivery device, which would mean they'd be subject to the FDA's punitive and prohibitive pre-market approval regulatory pipeline. Naturally, Big Tobacco did not share this view, which touched off a decade of legal battles. The tobacco wars flamed throughout the 90s, with Marlboro and Camel painted as the villains against Kessler, the upstanding hero. In March 2000, the FDA lost a Supreme Court case in which it was determined that cigarettes were not drug devices, but that proved to be just a battle, not the war. In 2009, President Barack Obama signed legislation that handed definitive regulatory control of tobacco to the FDA. By then, Kessler was out as FDA commissioner, but he eventually found a fun second career as COVID advisor to the Biden-Harris team. But this was a mere smoke break. The fight started afresh over vapes when they hit the American market, and in 2016, Obama signed the deeming rule, which allows the FDA to regulate whatever it deems to be a tobacco product. So that's it. The FDA now has absolute control over every single substance we consume. Smoking is a filthy habit, but so is government. Which is why Trump's slight relaxation of vape regulation is, paradoxically, a breath of fresh air. In May 2026, Trump's FDA announced it does not intend to prioritize enforcement against nicotine pouch and e-vapor products that have a pending pre-market tobacco application, PMTA, or a supplemental application accepted for more than 180 days. This might not sound like much, but in the context of the FDA's tightening noose over the past 90 years, it is a nearly unprecedented loophole that opens up a much quicker path to market for many smokeless tobacco devices. And it is, of course, great news for vape producers, like the one we are adding to this month's Best Buys. 1. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, is the world's second largest nicotine company. Why we recommended British American Tobacco? British American Tobacco owns the cigarette brands Lucky Strike, Pall Mall, and Dunhill, among others. But tobacco companies are moving away from tobacco and into reduced-risk, smokeless products. The world's largest category of less harmful nicotine is known as heated tobacco products, HTP. And British Tobacco has carved out a thriving business with Glo, its HTP brand, which in second place makes up a solid 18% market share globally. The fastest-growing product segment in the less harmful nicotine revolution is in nicotine pouches. Over the past few years, British Tobacco has been selling a product in the US market called Velo Plus, which is based on its European-style Velo pouches. Its market share in this category, though far behind the popular Zyn nicotine pouches, is growing steadily. In 2025, British American Tobacco generated $34 billion in revenue. That puts it just behind the number one industry leader, Philip Morris International, PM, which generated $40 billion in revenue. Yet, despite producing 85% of the revenue as its top competitor, British Tobacco's $140 billion market capitalization reflects a more than 50% discount to Philip Morris' $290 billion market capitalization. We believe this valuation gap will narrow significantly in the years ahead, sending the BTI share price higher. We have long believed that the market has underappreciated the strength of British Tobacco's smoke-free portfolio, and we see positive catalysts ahead that will improve its cash generation. We believe the growing popularity of Velo Plus nicotine pouches will soar from around 10% of the U.S. market to somewhere closer to 20% to 30% over the next couple of years. In some U.S. markets, including New York, Velo Plus has already achieved 20% market share. We also expect a crackdown on illegal vaping imports that have skirted FDA regulations and hurt the sales of legal products, like Vuse. When the strength of British Tobacco's smoke-free portfolio becomes apparent, we expect a similar revaluation that we've observed in shares of Philip Morris in recent years. Why British American Tobacco is a best buy. As investors wake up to British Tobacco's potential as a leader in the less harmful nicotine revolution, we see the potential for 15% to 20% annual compounded returns over the next decade. What's more, British Tobacco shares trade at a similar valuation as Philip Morris in late 2022 at just under 15x this year's expected free cash flow of $9.5 billion. As the market sees the strength of its smoke-free product portfolio, we see a scenario where the shares re-rate to a range of 16x to 20x free cash flow by year-end 2026. This would put its share price at approximately $71 to $88, up from the current price of $66. Action to take: buy British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, up to $86.54 per share to Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, is the global leader in the booming market for GLP-1 diabetes and weight loss drugs. Why we recommended Eli Lilly? The GLP-1 weight loss drug market is highly competitive and is driving the narrative in the pharmaceutical industry at the moment. Eli Lilly displaced the former industry leader, Novo Nordisk, NVO, achieving 50% market share last year, which it has since significantly surpassed. Its leading injectable diabetes drug Mounjaro, tirzepatide, has experienced massive growth, with Q1 2026 revenue hitting $8.7 billion, representing a 125% year-over-year increase. Combined with Zepbound, this growth is driven by high demand and expanded manufacturing, having been a key driver for Eli Lilly's revenue growth. Lilly projects 2026 revenue of $82 billion to $85 billion, driven by massive demand for these obesity drugs, and its projections for 2027 suggest revenue could reach close to $100 billion, representing continued, significant growth driven by the launch of oral GLP-1 orforglipron. Already, the booming sales of Eli Lilly's GLP-1 drugs have made it one of the fastest-growing pharmaceutical companies in the world. Since the 2022 launch of Mounjaro, the company's revenue has increased more than 20% each year, and this trend is expected to continue through at least 2029. Why Eli Lilly is a best buy? So far, the main GLP-1 drugs on the market come in an injectable form, including Mounjaro and Zepbound, as well as Novo Nordisk's Ozempic and Wegovy. More recently, big pharma companies have been racing to create the first pill form of the drug, which opens up a massive new source of demand from consumers who don't want to stab themselves with a needle. And so far, Lilly has led with a more consumer-friendly product on this. The FDA-approved Foundayo, orforglipron, as the only GLP-1 pill for weight loss that can be taken any time of day, without food or water restrictions, a meaningful consumer experience advantage over competing oral formulations in development. Foundayo launched to the public through Lilly Direct with shipping beginning April 6, followed by broad availability through U.S. retail pharmacies and telehealth providers, priced at $149 per month at the lowest dose for self-pay patients, with commercially insured patients eligible for as little as $25 per month. The overall weight loss market is still largely untapped, with only about 4% of Americans currently using the drugs, while 40% of the population is obese. Eli Lilly will continue to be one of the biggest winners from this trend, and it's just getting started. Analysts estimate the overall market will grow from around $50 billion today to between $100 billion to $150 billion by 2030. Q1 2026 revenue came in at $19.8 billion, up 56% year-over-year, blowing past Wall Street's estimate of $17.6 billion. Adjusted earnings per share of $8.55 similarly crushed the $6.66 consensus estimate, and shares rose more than 10% in afternoon trading. Despite a 8% dip in share price from its January high, Eli Lilly's underlying fundamentals have never been stronger. Medicare Part D coverage for Foundayo is set to begin July 1, 2026, with eligible enrollees able to pay as little as $50 per month, opening a significant new channel of demand. With a raised full-year revenue guide, a blockbuster Q1 now in the books, and Medicare coverage for Foundayo weeks away, Eli Lilly's bull case has only strengthened. Action to take. Buy Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, up to $1,828.75 per share. 3. LandBridge, NYSE, pound. LandBridge, NYSE, pound, is a leading land acquisition and management company in the Permian Basin. Why we recommended LandBridge? The company owns the surface rights to 315,000 acres of land in the heart of the Delaware Basin, making it the second largest landholder in the Permian Basin, behind only Texas Pacific Land, TPL, which owns about 870,000 acres. LandBridge earns royalties for every barrel of water injected into its land. It also collects royalties for allowing water to pass through its land via pipelines. These surface use royalties, as they are called, make up 72% of LandBridge's revenue, the largest portion of the business. The next largest component is resource sales and royalties at 22% of revenue. This revenue comes from the sales of produced water to shale drillers for use in fracking operations. Finally, the company also earns royalties from allowing the extraction of oil and gas on its properties, which makes up 6% of revenue. The thing we like about the business is that it primarily operates as a passive landholder, collecting royalty fees for the use of its land. This means minimal operating expenses and juicy profit margins. Over the past year, LandBridge took in $206 million in revenue and generated $136 million in EBITDA, for a remarkable 66% operating margin. And like most royalty companies, the business requires very few capital expenditures, allowing it to convert 80% of every dollar of revenue into free cash flow. LandBridge reported Q1 2026 results on May 6 that demonstrated continued strength. Revenue grew 16% YoY to $51.0 million, with EBITDA of $33.6 million and a 66% margin. Those results were consistent with management's internal plan, and the company followed them with a guidance raise. Full-year 2026 adjusted EBITDA guidance was increased to $210 million to $230 million, reflecting increased confidence in its commercial pipeline. Why LandBridge is a best buy? With water demand in the Permian continuing to rise and a dominant land position that its competitors can't replicate, we see a lucrative road ahead for LandBridge, and the story is getting bigger. In April, LandBridge entered a lease development agreement with data center manager PowerBridge, providing the option to lease up to 3,400 acres in Reeves County, Texas, for a gigascale campus with up to 2 gigawatts, GW, of power generation, a transformative expansion of the investment thesis beyond water royalties. LandBridge has identified approximately 25,000 acres of its land as suitable for data center development, a footprint it estimates could support as much as 18 gigawatts of total data center capacity. Given its rapid growth trajectory and a high-margin, asset-light business model, we view LandBridge as one of the highest-quality compounders in the market today. Action to take. Buy LandBridge, NYSE, pound, up to $104.31 per share. Every month, we highlight three current recommendations that are at an attractive buy point from all Porter & Company advisories, including Complete Investor, Tech Frontiers, and Distressed Investing. We include those with the best buying opportunity as our best buys. While we sometimes alternate which companies we list as our best buys, removing a stock from the list does not necessarily mean we no longer recommend it, nor does it imply a recommendation to sell shares in that company once it is no longer part of best buys. It's only that the new picks present an even more compelling investment opportunity. Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland.